Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joshua Donovan, and today I'm delighted to welcome Usama Mekdisi to the show. Dr. Mekdisi is a professor of history and the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University. This year, he is a visiting professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Mekdisi is the author of a number of groundbreaking studies on sectarianism, religion, and politics in the modern Middle East, including The Culture of Sectarianism, Artillery of Heaven, and Faith Misplaced. But today, we will be discussing his latest book, Age of Coexistence, The Ecumenical Frame and the Making of the Modern Arab World, which was published this year, 2019, by the University of California Press. Thank you so much for sitting down with us today, Professor Mekdisi.
Thank you so much for having me, Joshua. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to start just by having you introduce yourself briefly to the audience, and specifically, how did you come to work on Age of Coexistence? How does it sort of tie into or depart from your previous work?
So I, as you mentioned in the introduction, I spent a lot of time and I've spent a lot of time working on the question of sectarianism, having grown up in Lebanon during the Civil War, having spent over a decade working on this topic. I realized at some point when I was asked at one point earlier by a press to sort of expand the culture of sectarianism to sort of go beyond Mount Lebanon or Lebanon and expand it to the rest of the Middle East, especially in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the outbreak of sectarian violence there. And so I thought about that, and I started writing a book in part because of these informal discussions with editors, but in part also because it was something that I had been interested in. And then I realized midway through writing the first version of a manuscript, I realized that I was deeply unsatisfied with focusing again on sectarianism, having felt that I had already said what I have to say about the topic. And there's, there are tons of other people who are writing interesting things about sectarianism. And what I felt was much more urgent was this other tradition that that I knew intimately growing up, and having lived in the Middle East, this tradition that we call coexistence. And I felt that this tradition, this anti-sectarian tradition, this sort of tradition that brought people of different faiths together in fascinating ways, was something that was not just that we needed to remember, but also that needed a history, a proper modern history, that's not a romanticized history of the past as simple coexistence or some kind of idealized coexistence, but actually a critical history of coexistence, something that was actually that something that I felt that both lay people and scholars of the Middle East desperately needed to be reacquainted with, and I'm including myself in that as well. So it began as a history of sectarianism, but ended up being really, in a sense, a history of anti-sectarianism, and I think that's a field of inquiry that I think can be and should be an extraordinary opportunity for scholars of the Middle East to delve into, because it's really part and parcel of this extraordinary region and its history.
Well, so, and you call this anti-sectarianism the ecumenical frame in this book. And I'm wondering how you came to that title, especially given that when people use the term ecumenicalism or ecumenism, it usually refers to a Christian movement.
Correct. That is the conventional way, especially in the Protestant church and in the way Christian, the way it's used in the Protestant tradition, the ecumenical movement and ecumenism and so on. Of course, it has, as we know, much older and much deeper roots, you know, in terms of the word itself, in terms of its original meaning. But also, I'll point out that, of course, it's used among scholars of the Middle East to describe the Islamic tradition. I mean, so Islamic ecumenism is a term that's been around for a while. And the reason why I was attracted, there's two reasons why I ended up settling on the idea or the notion of the ecumenical frame. One is because in the very nature of the word ecumenism is this idea, especially this idea of something that brings people together, that allows them to transcend their differences, to recognize on the one hand and at the same time to transcend their differences. So it's not about the denial of difference, but at the same time it is about the emphasis on the transcendent commonality and the aspiration to achieve that commonality. And so that's at one level why I found the term so powerful and so compelling. So that's the first reason. The second reason, I think, is more to push back from what I felt for a while has been a dead end in the scholarship of the field in the modern Middle East, both I feel in anthropology of the Middle East, but also in some of the historical scholarship, which is to say this endless debate whether people are secular or religious, and as if there's always a choice to be made. Sometimes, of course, there is a choice to be made, but what I found much more interesting is how often people in the region, especially in the Mashriq, have come together, whether they come together in ecumenical terms, whether it's in secular, more secular versions of that ecumenism, whether it's in more pietistic versions of that ecumenism. But there is this very powerful anti-sectarian mobilization that gets expressed at different registers. But that does not posit religion versus secular, but is actually both at the same time in different ways. So I wanted to capture that reality as well, this idea that there's an extraordinarily living, powerful, anti-sectarian tradition that is incredibly ecumenical and that includes both Muslims and non-Muslims, Christians and non-Christians, Jews and non-Jews in this history. And so that's what I was trying to signal. And I know it's, you know, I still struggle with the term, honestly. And I know a lot of people, I have theologian friends who and colleagues who have, you know, who initially told me that I should use the term interfaith. But my point is, this is not about only religious people, and it's not simply a religious debate. This is a debate, a tradition, an ecumenical, anti-sectarian tradition that encompasses all sorts of people in the Mashriq, and it's a tradition that we need to be far more aware of.
Well, I'm not a theologian, but for what it's worth, I liked your term just because of how capacious this frame really is and how much it allows for a discussion that, as you said, sort of transcends binaries that I think are problematic between religious and secular. One of the historiographical moves that you make is to emphasize the Ottoman context in shaping this ecumenical frame. And I was struck by this for a couple of reasons. On the one hand, you push back a bit, or just gently, against narratives of Ottoman tolerance that have sort of crept up over the years, and argue that just as sectarianism has a history, so too does the sort of ecumenical frame or the anti-sectarianism. So what is at stake in telling or retelling 19th century Ottoman history and locating the ecumenical frame here?
Well, because I mean, one of the main thrusts of the book is to basically push back against what I see as pervasive denial as I said, at the most basic level, the denial of this rich, extraordinarily rich and humane anti-sectarian traditionalist ecumenical tradition, the ecumenical frame, as I call it, in the region. And to understand that, we have to understand where it began. And as far it's, so you could think of ecumenism or the ecumenical frame at one level, you know, the simple way is to say, well, this goes back a long way in the history of the Middle East. But my point was to emphasize how my understanding of modern coexistence is tied profoundly to the idea of equality and citizenship. And these terms, for all their flaws and all their criticisms, and there's been a huge amount, as you know, scholarship that's criticized liberal understandings of citizenship and so on. But in the case of the Ottoman Empire, and as in the case of virtually every other polity of the 19th century, where such questions of equality arose, it led to profound questions. How to organize diversity on an equal basis? What does that mean? How do you take hitherto discriminated against communities and transform them into equal citizens? What are the problems? How does this manifest itself? How did it manifest itself in different ways? And so for me, the obvious starting point for this history would have been the 19th century Ottoman Empire, when the very question of citizenship and equality first arise in substantial and meaningful ways. And so that's why I began in the Ottoman period. And then, of course, my point is that this history doesn't just end with the end of the Ottoman Empire. It continues after the Ottoman Empire all the way. Honestly, I think you still see it when you travel in the Mashriq. You can still feel it and live it, in a sense, despite the sensationalized representations of the Middle East as an endless place of sectarianism and so on and so forth. So that's an answer as to why the Ottomans. But as you know, having read the book, I hope, or at least I hope I made this clear, that my emphasis is not simply on Ottoman bureaucrats or Ottoman statesmen, but it's also on, of course, the subjects and then later citizens, both in the Ottoman period and in the post-Ottoman period, as they grappled with this question of how exactly and how precisely to manage this extraordinarily fraught transition from an empire of subjects to one of citizens, from overt ideological discrimination against non-Muslims and non-Ottomans to this sort of late 19th century empire. And what's fascinating is to track how the empire, despite its extraordinary diminishment in the 19th century as a political sovereign, what's fascinating is how I was struck by how this empire both allowed for this extraordinary anti-sectarian ecumenical frame to develop on the one hand, and on the other hand, in different parts of the empire in particular, and I emphasize the Balkans, there was a very different, it seems to me, trajectory. Of course, I'm generalizing here a little bit, but a different trajectory in the sense that there you see a much more statist, nationalist understanding that develops and takes place and really shapes the region, the Balkans, and then, of course, Anatolia. So I think the Ottoman Empire is crucial.
So stepping outside of the bureaucrats, then some of the people in the Mashriq who were developing this or seemed to be part of this ecumenical frame were Nahdawis, right, or the intellects and writers who were contributing to the Nahda. And I was also sort of struck by your characterization of these Nahdawis, and I don't disagree with how you discuss them, but you point out things that aren't often emphasized, right? So you point out, for example, that many of these Nahda thinkers were sort of conservative, elitist. There's a paternalism to their work. So I'm curious, what were some of the limits then of the Nahda, and what does this tell us about the ecumenical frame itself, if one of the major sources of ecumenism, as you describe it, comes from this Nahda movement?
Well, I mean, there's two points to be said to that. The first, of course, that there is no, as I say in the book, there is no, and I think as most scholars would agree, I hope, there was no single overarching Nahda project that was sort of defined as such, that was centralized in a major way. So I think that's important to understand that the Nahda itself is a term that we use Although, of course, it was coined in the late 19th century, but the way people think of the Nahda is they often think of it as a totalizing project. So we produce anthologies of the Nahda. There's a brand new anthology, a great anthology, in fact, that just came out on a bilingual anthology of the Nahda, which sort of gives it a sort of coherence that it doesn't necessarily have as a single monolithic political project. Not that they're suggesting that. But so I wanted to push back against this idea just because I realized people, especially, again, considering where we are in the Arab world today and how much disillusionment there is in the Arab world. So what you often get are people who say the Nahda failed, or the Nahda was false promise, or the Nahda was X, or the Nahda was Y. But it's always, or not always, but often extraordinarily defeatist and almost to the point, I would say, of self-loathing. In that you find, you know, a sense of despair, really, in the Arab world, given how wretched the state of affairs is currently in the Arab world. And my point was to push back against that, not again by romanticizing, but by pointing out that, in fact, the Nahda itself, you know, this moment that we call the Nahda belonged, of course, to an Ottoman moment that itself was affected, influenced, shaped by a number of external inputs. And so you had this space that developed in the context of the Tanzimat, in the context of the declaration of non-discrimination as an imperial policy, and then eventually citizenship, equal citizenship, and in the context of a common Arabic language, in the context of the rise of the press. And these are things that scholars of the region, of course, know well. There was a development of this moment in post-1860, I say specifically in the book, where this idea of what it means to be equal citizens, what it means to be civilized, what it means to be anti-sectarian develops in a noticeable way and takes on different strands. And what my point was by the conservative aspect is that far from being a radical, you know, project, it was radical in some ways, insofar as equality, I think, is often a radical project. And certainly a radical idea to those who were invested in the older ways. But I think it's also important to understand just how conservative certain aspects of the Nahda were, and just how ultimately the consensus that emerges around equal citizenship on the one hand and a religiously informed or sectarian personal status on the other, that sort of binary, that dualism, you know, it is what I find so fascinating. About this conservative, not necessarily in a good way, but because it's got all sorts of inequalities built into it. You know, the Nahda was deeply gendered, it was deeply elitist, but at the same time, it was also fundamentally different from what came before, but it wasn't a unified total project. I don't know if that makes it clear. That's what I was trying to get at. And to go back to your point about Ottoman tolerance, if I may, I mean, the reason I was pushing back against, I mean, I'm pushing it back against two things. One, this defeatist attitude of today that I feel, that the despair of today, where people say, oh man, we're terrible, we're backwards, we're this, we haven't learned. Especially you see this in not necessarily among historians of the Middle East as much as among, I would say, people who think about the history of the Middle East, journalists in the Middle East and so on, and people who care deeply about the region who are, as I said, in a sense of despair today. These people, I'm trying to push back and say, look, understand that the transition from inequality to equality, the transition from subject to citizenship, the transition from non-discrimination to something greater, something more positive, actual compatriotship in all its meanings and all its senses, was fraught in every part of the world, including, of course, the U.S. and including Europe. And this is something that I really insist on in the beginning of the book, if you would have noticed, and the epilogue as well, that I'm tired of works that always judge the Middle East as somehow especially sectarian or especially backwards. And I'm trying to say no, to understand this region in all its complexity, without defensiveness, you have to appreciate the fact that this was just one site of what I consider to be a global revolution on the one hand and problem on the other.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. I was particularly struck, for example, by your comparison or your reference to emancipation in the United States in the 19th century, right? So just as you're moving from a position of inequality to something that better resembles unity, diversity, coexistence, but also equality in the Ottoman Empire, you know, these are issues, as you said, that are global. And it struck me as an important reminder that sometimes I think we lose sight of. So what's that?
Well, not just a reminder, it's not just a reminder. It's also, I think it's an essential that keeping that global context in mind and keeping that comparative framework in mind, even if one is not doing an actual comparative history, just as a juxtaposition, it's really important to push back against what I really do consider to be either insidious Orientalist representations of the Middle East as somehow peculiar and backward, or the sense of defeatism of people who think, oh, this is terrible, or people who think that, who just think of the Middle East, or want to think of the Middle East entirely, you know, as its own sort of place, without actually understanding that in fact, the traumas and the transitions in the Middle East, you know, have parallels in other parts of the world. And once you understand that, you can then better delve into those traumas without defensiveness. Once you realize that the U.S. is not, I mean, I really do believe, we can see this today, of course, with Trump, or anyone who's followed U.S. politics for as long as the U.S. has been around, will of course understand this, that inequality and discrimination and racism and brutality are every bit as much a part of the history of the United States as are the more positive elements. And it's not to, and just like historians don't grossly generalize about the U.S., so too, I think it's incumbent upon us to approach the Middle East with more humility, I think. The history of the Middle East, that is, the history of the Arab world in particular.
So then after the Ottoman context, we move to what some scholars classify as a pretty disruptive moment, a break, if you will, in the history of the modern Middle East, and that is the emergence of the British and French mandate systems. And there's a bit of a debate going on, as you well know, and some of our listeners may be aware, within the scholarly community about the extent to which this is a decisive break, or should we instead look for continuities with the Ottoman Empire. So I'm curious, when it comes to the ecumenical frame, you don't emphasize so much Britain and France. You talk about them, of course, somewhat, but I mean, there are a number of works that really, really emphasize Britain and France as sort of being particularly sectarianizing. So I'm curious how Britain and France play into this ecumenical frame, or I should say colonialism.
Well, that's a great question, and of course, well, colonialism. I mean, when you talk about colonialism in terms of post World War One, the end of the Ottoman Empire, we are talking essentially about Britain and France. And Britain even more so than France, but France also, of course, in Syria and Lebanon plays a massive role. And of course, I acknowledge this, and I say this, in fact, in the book. I mean, yes, of course, these are, you know, they play a huge role. They go from being, you know, players in the Ottoman scene to being the shapers, of course, of the political architecture of the post-Ottoman world. I mean, every scholar knows that. And as you said, there are really fantastic works by scholars working on either British or French colonialism. The last colonialism, one should emphasize. This is like or at least the first colonialism in the name of self-determination, that shapes shapes the formation of the modern political Arab world in the Middle East. And so I'm completely, obviously, totally aware of that. And I'm not in any way trying to downplay the sectarianizing impulses of the French, for example, in Lebanon and in Syria. But my point was to say that we know that already. And the question is not to deny that, but in fact to point out, in terms of the story of the ecumenical frame and its anti-sectarian fundament, which of course began in the Ottoman period, is how that continues in the face of British and French colonial, or in the context of British and French colonialism. Because remember that the very notion of being Arab, an Arab nationalist, an Egyptian nationalist, an Iraqi nationalist, a Syrian nationalist, in all these contexts, it always presupposes, of course, in this period, opposition to, at one level, a British or French, depending on which context we're talking about, a notion that without Britain and France and without their tutelage, their colonial tutelage, this part of the world would fragment into warring, sectarian, ethnic, religious, tribal, fragments, and that the British and the French pretend to be the ones that keep things together. And so a lot of the mobilization, in fact, the anti-sectarian mobilization, was mobilized precisely against British or French colonial claims and their sort of racist discourse against Arabs in general. So, and that's why, in fact, the figure of Sa'd al-Husseini in one of the chapters is so important. But my point was to say the story predates the direct last colonialism or the first colonialism in the name of self-determination. It predates that story and it continues under in the context of that colonialism, and it postdates, it continues after the end of the formal colonial era. So I didn't want to emphasize what people I think already know incredibly well, that the British and the French played an extraordinarily negative role in the Middle East. And in fact, in my discussion of Zionism and Palestine, as well as Iraq, and Lebanon for that matter, I don't actually, since those are the cases I deal with in the post-Ottoman period, I don't actually, the colonial context is a given. Of course it's there, it's essential. But I don't want to spend all my time talking about what Imperial Administrator A or B said or did, because it's been done. And I'm much more interested in talking about the anti-sectarian tradition that developed in the Ottoman period.
So this is actually one of the most fascinating parts for me in your book, because then you mentioned one of the figures that you explore more fully, Sa'd al-Husseini, but the other is Michel Shiha, right, of Lebanon. Two extraordinarily different figures with very different visions of how to grapple with the question of diversity in newly drawn nation states in the Middle East during the Mandate period. And unless I'm mistaken, it seems that you're arguing that both of them draw on the ecumenical frame, but they do so in very different ways. I'm wondering if you could just, for our listeners, explain briefly who Shiha and al-Husseini were, and then kind of talk about their competing visions of political equality or at least pluralism, I guess one might say.
Yeah, I think it's more pluralism than political equality, especially in the case of Shiha. But I think both, obviously, as you mentioned, these are two figures that I focus on because they played Shiha in the case of the new state of Lebanon, Husseini in the case of the new state of Iraq, both created after World War I and after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and after the end of this common Ottoman sovereignty or this unified sovereign state. The Shiha, of course, in the literature on Lebanon is well known insofar as he's often identified as the man who played a leading role in devising the sectarian architecture of the modern Lebanese state, and someone, in other words, who we think of as committed to this idea that the only way and the most realistic way, this is of course his, I don't accept this, but he said this, or he believed this, the most the only way to sort of guarantee the religious diversity of the Orient and of Lebanon, he was fixated on Lebanon, of course, was to create a sectarian political system that guaranteed different communities a voice, a formal voice in this country, in this new country. So in other words, for him, sectarianism was, or the, a sectarian political culture was a way to organize religious difference and to formalize religious difference in a way that gave, in theory at least, each quote-unquote major community a place around the table. So nobody felt excluded. At least this was the idea. Now, of course, what, as I point out in the book, what he excludes, or what he conveniently forgets and papers over, is the fact that this system was created, of course, in the context of French colonialism. It was and that the creation of Lebanon itself was, again, part and parcel of a colonial history and violence against Syria, violence in the Mashriq, colonial violence, all of which Shiha tends to paper over. And of course, the entire Lebanese system was created and fundamentally weighted in favor of the Maronite political elite in the country. So, but if we just step back a bit, you see the way what he's telling us is he's making this argument that the way to organize diversity realistically is not to pretend that everyone is secular or everyone is equally, national in a kind of neutral way, but in fact to emphasize religious difference. And so it's one way of approaching this question of sectarian difference in the Middle East, to take the social reality of religious, of multiple religious communities, and then to transform it into a political system. And so his approach is to sectarianize. But of course, he claimed at least that this was the more realistic way of dealing with difference. And his idea in theory, and according to the Lebanese constitution, as I point out, the idea is that we're meant at some stage in the future to transcend sectarian difference by recognizing sectarian difference initially. That's the myth or the idea. And I point this out. And scholars debate, of course, whether he was sincere, whether this was just a maneuver, and so on. But my point is that he's powerfully cognizant of the fact of religious diversity in the region and its ecumenical heritage. But he chooses, in the context of aligning himself with French colonialism, to create one way to present us with one path, a path, of course, that we see increasingly in evidence in places like Iraq and Syria, that says to the realistic way of dealing with diversity is to recognize this diversity politically and to entrench it in the system. But again, his idea was he would claim that he did that as a mechanism to reach a non-sectarian future. That's his argument. Husari, of course, in Iraq is a completely different had a different project insofar as that he came out of an Ottoman educational milieu. He was a really well-known Ottoman pedagogue, a modernizer, and he ends up working on a much reduced political canvas of Iraq. And so from the Ottoman scale, he ends up in the Iraqi context, working with King Faisal, who of course was put there by the British. But Husari had really believed in a secular nationalist Arabist project. So his way of unifying difference was by sort of, doing as much as he could to sort of supersede that difference, to transcend it immediately by emphasizing the common Arabism. But of course, it had its own biases and its own blind spots, as I point out in the book. But my point is that Husari at least was working against a colonial project at a certain way, and insofar as that ultimately his very clear goal was to create a secular Arab nation. Now, of course, there are people who are left out of that, the Kurds and others who are, he just doesn't have the time of day for. As I said, he has all these blind spots and his biases. But his argument was that the way to transcend religious difference was not to emphasize religious difference or sectarian difference, because that would only entrench this problem and make it essentially, impossible to deal with, as opposed to Shiha, who entrenched religious difference and sectarian difference in the name of transcending it.
So one of the things that I noticed that both figures have in common, and of course, people who study the Middle East know this, is that both of them still allow for personal status laws. Even in Iraq, it's not following the Shiha model specifically, but But there's still a lot of deference given to religious communities. I'm wondering if you had thoughts on why that is so persistent, not just, of course, in the mandate period, but even today, in all of the various iterations of the ecumenical frame that have been, personal status seems to be really stubborn, a gendered personal status in particular.
Well, I think personal status is always gendered, no matter if it's secular or allegedly religiously informed. I think it's always gendered. And I think the point is, I think it's a good question. But before I get to that question, if I could just go back to the Shia Husari, you know, juxtaposition. Again, so why I juxtapose those two figures is in part because also in the literature of the modern Middle East, as you know, when one ends up studying the Mandate of Iraq or Iraqi history, you end up looking primarily at Iraqi figures or the figures in Iraq, such as Husari, and you tend not to be in any conversation with parallel figures in other parts of the region. And so my point was, and precisely the same for Lebanon. There's like these nationalist sort of silos or these historiographies. Even when one is criticizing the nationalist orthodoxies, we tend to look at and to engage with, for understandable reasons, these figures that are in Lebanon or in Iraq or in Syria, and we tend not, or in Egypt especially, and we tend not to, you know, take very seriously or even examine or even pretend to examine these other figures. If anything, the scholarship tends to be we take Western theory seriously and then we tend to apply it in the Middle East rather than engage with how people in the Middle East itself, in various parts of the Arab world, in various mandates, grappled with very similar issues, but in extraordinarily different ways. So I really want to emphasize that point. As to your question, remind me, I'm sorry.
Yeah, just the persistence. No worries. Well, and I should add, I also find these two characters very fascinating because, you know, even as they're very influential in their respective post-war nation states, both of them have, you know, really sort of transnational biographies, if you will. I mean, Shiha's family has, correct me if I'm wrong, but origins in Iraq, right? And Husri, of course, was sort of a trans-imperial Ottoman figure. So there is a certain irony, I think, that they can so well become the epitome of their national models.
Correct. And they're both being characterized and sort of caricatured, especially Husari more recently. Husari is being caricatured in an absurd way as just a sectarian Sunni. This is how he's often represented today in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, as just as a, quote, Sunni figure. And all the complexity of what Husari stood for, all the pedagogy, all that is sort of treated by most scholars. I mean, there are exceptions. As somehow a Sunni figure, and it's an absurd, characterization of Husari, and the same to a lesser extent with Shiha. He's often described simply as a right wing, sectarian fanatic, and of course you could say that, but then you don't actually deal with the fact that, or as a counter revolutionary, or as an anti revolutionary. But the truth of the matter is that it's a much more complicated period. And I don't, again, part of what I was trying to do in this book is to get people to engage with aspects and histories that they're not necessarily comfortable doing, and actually exposing myself in the process. I mean, here I am, you know, moving from the 19th century into the 20th century. So from Ottoman to post-Ottoman, Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, the Balkans, the Arab world, and so on and so forth. And so I'm just trying to push us as much as possible. And I, as I said, I include myself in this, into to think about the conventional wisdoms with which we've become accustomed to.
Excellent. So I do, if you're willing, I would like to return to the question of just personal status laws and the persistence. If you have any thoughts on why they persist in the ecumenical frame.
Well, look. I mean, part of the argument that I make in the book, and this, remember, this is just as a proposition in a sense, hypothesis, is that I'm trying to say this is my understanding of how the ecumenical frame develops, and it does, although I find it at one level to be extraordinarily important insofar as dealing with questions of equality and questions of citizenship and this and this momentous transition from subjecthood to citizenship and formal ideological discrimination against non-Muslims to a period in which non-Muslims played a major role in the elaboration, especially of equal citizenship. But also, of course, Muslim, Ottoman, and Arab figures played a massive role as well. And the idea was to say, but ultimately the consensus, the overlapping consensus, the overlapping consensus that develops in the region is one where there is this bifurcation or this dualism, both of which are constructed at more or less the same time between secular citizenship on the one hand and what we would call sectarian personal status laws or religiously informed personal status laws on the other. And they develop simultaneously. But the point I try to make is because I think it's fundamentally a conservative move. It allows for people who are religious and pietistic and conservative in those, as opposed to liberation theologians, in other words, people who have more conservative interpretations and positions, whether they're religious or secular, to be at ease with the idea of secular citizenship. This is one way that allows for buy-in to this system. A, on the one hand, B, there was no consensus on secular uniform civil status, uniform civil code. There is no, in terms of family law, there is no consensus, but there was a consensus on equal citizenship. That's what I find remarkable. So that people have, by the mid-20th century, very little problem in the Mashrik with the idea of equality between Muslim and non-Muslim, and Muslim and Christian in particular. But there is tremendous resistance to the idea of a uniform civil code. And again, it's worth exploring as to why that is, but it's also worth pointing out, as again, scholars who've worked on this on personal status in Egypt or in Lebanon, these are always contested, and in Iraq, these are always contested, negotiated codes. And so even though we call them sectarian personal status codes or religiously informed personal status codes, there's no agreement. There's always pushback, especially among women activists who fight for equal rights or for better rights under the rubric of a more equitable interpretation of what Islamic or Christian or Druze or whatever it is personal status may be. So my point is that it's still an ongoing, it's still a deeply contested, but there is absolutely, as far as I can tell, no consensus anywhere in the region. It's one of the riddles for me as to why there's no call. It's not a riddle, as I say. I think it's because of the fundamentally conservative nature of the ecumenical frame and its foundation. There's no genuine mobilization. I mean, every now and then there's a push for it, but it gets shut down very quickly for secular personal status.
Right. And well, and these, as you well know, and as some of our listeners who may follow the news in the region know, that issues of personal status and, in Lebanon, for example, questions of civil marriage, right, continue to come up and be debated.
All the time. Yeah.
So I am kind of curious then, because both Shihan al-Husri are so different, and they're both different in some ways than the Nahdawis, and you include in the book references to other very diverse figures who are all sort of part of this ecumenical frame, the co-founders of the Ba'ath Party. I think you mentioned Hassan al-Banna, Shikib Arslan, King Faisal, the SSNP, the Communist Party. There's so many people. What is included then in the ecumenical frame, and what, if anything, exists outside of it?
Well, I mean, as I say in the book, of course, I don't spend as much time on the Muslim Brotherhood or on the SSNP or the Communist Parties or the Ba'ath Party, for that matter. All these parties that you just mentioned, I allude to these parties and organizations in part because part of what I'm trying to say is my fervent hope is that we create a new agenda for research which focuses on the anti-sectarian tradition, on this ecumenical frame and all its diversity. And that's really what I'm hoping for. So hopefully other scholars will come along and correct, push back or whatever, my work. or this idea of the ecumenical frame. But my point is that these are all what's fascinating is that they all, you know, are fundamentally accept the ecumenical frame insofar as almost all these movements accept the idea of a vibrant multi-religious landscape in which they live to a greater or lesser extent, with contradictions, with caveats, with so on. But there's you know, in overwhelmingly in Syria, in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Egypt, there in Iraq, there's this idea that these are in fact vibrant multi-religious societies. And of course, the massive debates are about how to politicize this, you know, whether to do it in a more secular or more sectarian way, a more Islamic, a more secular way, and so on and so forth. But they all, I think, fundamentally adhere to more or less conservative interpretations of the ecumenical frame. As to who comes on the outside, I mean, the example I gave in the book in terms of the Palestine case is, of course, colonial Zionism. And that's because it actually does come from the outside. It comes from Europe. And the Zionist movement in its that I focus on in the book, of course, these are people who are themselves, by their own admission, coming from Europe and are not interested ultimately in sort of adhering to an Ottoman landscape or an Ottoman heritage or the ecumenical frame, but in fact in creating an exclusive Jewish state in Palestine. And so and so that's why I track that fascinating, I mean, in a tragic way, development the of what happens to the ecumenical frame, I mean, in terms of how it actually comes under massive pressure in Palestine, and ultimately is collapses in Palestine, was destroyed in Palestine with the Nakba of 1948, and then of course with what happens to Arab Jewish communities elsewhere in the Mashriq.
So right. So you mostly stop your narrative then in 1948, although you have an epilogue where you talk a bit about the rise of nominally secular authoritarianisms in the Middle East, and then in the late 70s, the what some scholars have called the Islamist turn, right, somewhat problematically. But I'm curious if you have thoughts on the state of the ecumenical frame, either today or the second half of the 20th century. Are you optimistic?
Well, I think, you know, look, as I say at the end, you know, it's hard to be, it's hard to be optimistic about the state of the world today. I wouldn't claim to be optimistic anymore, but what I genuinely am in terms of looking at this history is, full of respect and, as I said, humility for all the figures, past and present. I mean, that's part of what I'm trying to say, is that the ecumenical frame, despite Palestine, despite the Nakba, despite the destruction of Arab Palestine, despite the massive imperial reach, and this is one of the points that I find in the scholarship astonishing, is just how the obviousness of colonialism in the Middle East in terms of post-World War I, as I said, the last major colonialism that I'm aware of, maybe there are other places, but in the world, and as I said, the first colonialism in the name of self-determination, this kind of massive shock that takes place and that we still live with, despite all that, there persists in the Middle East, in the Arab world, in the Mashriq. What's amazing is to see the persistence of people who keep fighting for precisely the values that I identify with. In other words, humanism, you know, equality, you know, and so on. And so that's what I find in liberation. And that's what I find profoundly moving. And so for me, so rather than end on a down note, yes, you don't need me to tell you that the situation in the Middle East is terrible. But on the other hand, I say, look around the world and see that it's the same fight that manifests in different ways, in different contexts. And so the allies are everywhere, and the enemies, of course, are all over the place as well. And so my point ultimately is to say, look at all the amazing moments of not just of solidarity, but also of insistence upon an ecumenical culture that persists in virtually every society in the Mashriq, despite the extraordinary violence, despite the catastrophic violence that's taken place in places like Iraq, in places like Syria, and scholars need to be attentive to that. Otherwise, we end up in these extraordinarily seductive and reductive narratives of, you know, Sunni and Shi'i and X and Y, and we've done a huge disservice to the history, to the living history of this region.
Well, thank you so much. We like to close these interviews by asking where you're going next, right? What research threads are you pulling on? I know this book is just coming out, so you're probably taking a slightly well-deserved break. But what sorts of questions are you interested in pursuing in the future?
I'm not really, it's true. I just finished the book right now, so I'm kind of, I'm still thinking, but I think something along the lines of, the King Crane Commission, but I'm not entirely sure, to be absolutely honest with you. I'm not really sure. I'm hoping though that people take up this call to study the anti-sectarian, history, the tradition and all its varieties and all its contradictions as a point of departure rather than always focusing on sectarianism. And that's really my hope. And I hope that that we'll see many more works that refine the arguments that I put forward in this book.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.